surgical palliative care may seem counterintuitive, but surgeons have a rich history of palliating both their patients and their families. I am Red Hoffman, an acute care surgeon in Asheville, North Carolina, and one of 79 surgeons currently board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. Join me as I interview the founders and the leaders of the surgical palliative care movement, a diverse group of surgeons dedicated to providing high-quality palliative medicine to all surgical and trauma patients. Welcome to the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. We heal with more than steel. Hi, everyone. This is Red Hoffman. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Janet Bull. Janet initially trained and practiced as an obstetrician and gynecologist, and now works as a chief medical officer and chief innovation officer of Four Seasons, a nonprofit hospice and palliative care organization in Western North Carolina. She is also a past president of the American Association of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. Janet, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Red. It's nice to be here.
I'm super excited to chat. So as we're getting started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you trained, and why you pursued a career in obstetrics and gynecology?
Sure. I grew up in Miami, Florida, and I went to school in Texas, in Dallas, at SMU and then Southwestern Med School. When I was at SMU as a junior, I was getting ready to transfer to do I was thinking I wanted to be a physical therapist like my mom had been. And so I went into my guidance counselor, and he refused to sign my transfer. He said, you know, I think you're not going to like being a PT, so why don't you volunteer and then come back and we'll chat. So I did exactly that. I spent a couple of days at the local physical therapist office, and for somebody like me who's a little bit ADHD, I was somewhat bored. And then I went to Parkland Emergency Room, and it was there amidst, I think they had five emergency rooms that I could rotate through. And Red, you can visualize this because back in those days, you had to wear one of those pink pinafore uniforms. So I know you can visualize me in that. But it was there that as kind of a candy striper volunteer that I put in my first sutures, and I learned that you had to deflate the balloon of a Foley catheter before pulling it out.
Oh, yes.
So anyway, so I decided then to change to medicine and went to Southwestern there in Dallas for 4 years. And during my fourth year, I just fell in love with obstetrics and gynecology. So I then went to University of Alabama to do an OBGYN residency. From there, it was private practice in Atlanta for a number of years.
How did you end up becoming involved in hospice and palliative medicine?
The story is that my office manager, who was a dear person, a wonderful friend, was in her 30s, and she was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. And over the course of the next 2 to 3 months, I just witnessed the challenges that people with serious illness care go through. And I was with her through some of that journey, and she ended up dying in a very small cubicle in an ICU in Emory. I did a visualization with her before that period when she was unconscious and could see her blood pressure come down and her pulse stabilize. And she passed later that day. And there was something about that experience, honestly, that really birthed my interest. No pun intended there. Really birthed my interest in hospice and palliative medicine. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came into town about a month later, and I went to hear her and was just fascinated by her stories. And so I think that's really what laid the groundwork for me thinking about changing careers and figuring out how we could do death better in this country.
So what did that look like for you personally, going from this private practice OB-GYN to focusing more on care of serious illness and then end-of-life care?
Well, it was somewhat of a circuitous route. At the time, we decided to move out of Atlanta. And so we actually bought a pop-up camper. And with a 2 and a 3-year-old, we traveled the country for 2 to 3 months, kind of looking at places we wanted to live. And so we ended up in Asheville. Actually, we were on the French Broad River campground when my kids started school. And so I volunteered for hospice there, and I did some locum tenens work for my old practice in Atlanta for a couple of years. And then Four Seasons, I initially started there as a volunteer, and then I was just hooked. My thoughts really were to do half-time OB-GYN and half-time hospice and palliative medicine, but I just got sucked in and loved it, and it quickly morphed into a full-time job, and we started building the program, and, you know, and one thing led to another. And before I knew it, you know, I was working 50 or 60 hours and loving every minute of it.
Wow. You know, when I'm sitting with families during the dying process, I'll often tell them that dying is a lot like being born, that it really can be in some times like a beautiful, profound experience, but that everyone certainly does it in their own way and on their own time frame. And I'm sure as an obstetrician, you've thought a lot about the similarities and differences between these two events. Can you talk a little more about that?
Oh, sure. You know, that book I've started about 3 times is really all about that. I think that there is a lot of similarities between birth and death. And for me, you know, as a provider, it's just been an incredible experience to be involved with people at the most vulnerable time in their life. And I think childbirth brings up those emotions for patients and families, and you get very, very closely connected with your obstetrician. And the same thing that happens in the dying process. And I think a good birth is very similar to a good death. They have some of the same components: love, compassion, connection, laughter, tears, you know, and so, and the same way I think as people prepare for birth, those that prepare for death have an easier transition. So I think there are so many similarities, even as people kind of are, you know, it's kind of like going backwards in time as people are getting closer to the dying process. They often lose some of their abilities, you know, kind of thinking about a 2-year-old going backwards, and they need help with walking and maybe toileting and feeding. So you tend to sometimes lose those facilities as you get closer to the dying process.
I love that idea of, I think of that so much when people are dying, that there is so much, there's room for so much laughter and yeah, love in there, and then it doesn't have to be all about sadness.
You know, I think a lot of it is about stories, and every one of us has a unique story to tell. And it's, you know, such an honor to be with families and to hear their stories. What are the things they're the most proud of? What are the things that were the most challenging in their life? You know, and it often comes down to connection with people that you love and hopefully work that you love. And, you know, some stories are messy. I mean, we all have messy stories, right? But, you know, it's just to be able to allow somebody to tell their story and to be able to laugh with them and sometimes cry with them and, just to be a witness to that. There's something really powerful about that connection.
Yeah, we have the best job, I think.
Yeah, very true.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how you started the palliative care program at Four Seasons? And then in particular, how you were able to establish this relatively small nonprofit agency in Western North Carolina into a nationally recognized clinical research department?
Sure. I started in 2000, And I started seeing hospice patients. Obviously, we didn't have a palliative care program. And, you know, it was so challenging because so many people that were getting referred were in the last week of life. And the families were really struggling to come to grips in terms with the fact that they were losing somebody they loved. And you could see that this had been going on, not for a week, but for months. And there was no one really there helping to prepare them and manage their symptoms well. And so I started reading about palliative care. I have always been fortunate to pick really good mentors. So at my first academy meeting, I went to the booth and I said, "Hey, I'm new to this field. I feel like a fish out of water. I'm an OBGYN doc, but can you point me to somebody who could help me?" And it just happened that Martha Twaddle was
oh my goodness.
So anyway, I went up to her and, you know, explained who I was, and she immediately put her arm around me and said, "I can help you." And actually, she's one of my closest friends now. And so it's, you know, it's funny how you're there for each other on the journey. But she's been one of those people for me. So in the early days, you know, I'd call her and say, "Hey, I need help with this. You know, how do you manage a DVT? You know, we're..." So I didn't really have that background. So anyway, we started our palliative care program because we knew it was the right thing to do. And so we brought on a wonderful CEO, Chris Como, who really was innovative and willing to try new things. And we thought at the time, you know, I thought, gosh, we need to follow people wherever they go. It'll be a travesty if we just have a palliative care clinic, or we just see people in the hospital. So, you know, we were kind of dawning, and we just started the program and hired some nurse practitioners and followed people wherever they went. And I think that was, you know, that was really important so that we could be on that journey with that patient and family. And then in 2004, I happened to go to a talk in town, and some of the listeners may know Amy Abernathy, who became really one of my other big mentors, and she was giving a talk on evidence-based medicine and palliative care, and she had just gotten funded to do a trial looking at the benefits of oxygen versus air in people, you know, who were not hypoxic. And so I, after her talk, I went up and we actually spent about 4 hours. And, you know, I thought, well, gosh, we'll just build a research department, being a little bit naive. And so that's what we did. And one of our very first nurse practitioners became our first research coordinator, and then we grew from there. And we've conducted about 50 clinical trials at Four Seasons. We brought in some great people to help teach me and mentor me in that area. Amy and I also are very dear friends, and she was an incredible mentor. And we built this community academic partnership. I always laughed and said that it was, you know, Amy was the brain and we were the brawn, because we knew how to get the work done, and we relied on some of the great folks at Duke to help us with the stats and help us think through how to do some projects. So we worked closely together. And then, you know, Amy brought in Arif Kamal as a fellow who helped us on our, we had started the palliative care database, which then morphed into the QDAC, or the Global Palliative Care Quality Alliance, using the QDAC tool. And so that really, you know, so then we started writing grants, and then, you know, have done a lot in that field. So we built our program, and we currently now have about 1,300 or 1,400 palliative care patients and about 425 hospice patients. So it's a big program.
It's incredible. Can you talk a bit more about that QDAC tool?
Sure. So this is how one of the ideas started. Is we had written a grant on funding palliative care in the hospitals and in the nursing centers. And the first time we looked at our data, We brought in, I think we had about 6 or 7 nurse practitioners working for us. John Morris, who you know is a great partner, was a great partner for Seasons, and now he's at Teleos. But John was very instrumental in helping build our program. So we brought all these providers in, and we started looking at data. And we went through charts laboriously, and then, you know, I thought there's got to be a better way to do this. And Amy is always about 5 steps ahead of me. And so she had been kind of working on this, you know, this whole idea of creating this database. And so we brought some other leaders into the field, like Laura Hansen, and we all road tripped to Duke, and we sat around a room and started figuring out what those elements should be. And so, and then later when Arif came into Duke, he's the one who coined the term QDAC, the Quality Data Assessment Collection Tool. And we expanded the project in the Carolinas. We had a consortium of 4 programs working together, looking at data together. And the Duke Endowment has been tremendous in helping to fund this project. And as we were giving some talks around the country, people were interested in becoming, you know, part of this database project. And so that's where, you know, the term, the Global Palliative Care Quality Alliance, was birthed, and other people could join. And we came a kind of a learning center where every month we had calls. We did some presentations from some other leaders in the research world and looked at our data and did projects together. And then recently, some of you may know, we brought together the group from Duke, the GPCQA that I just mentioned, and the Palliative Care Quality Network that Steve Panelat heads in San Francisco, and the CAPSI registry, the data registry. And we now have one big organization called the Palliative Care Quality Collaborative that will be open for membership probably in May or June of this year. So stay tuned.
Of all the projects that you've worked on, I'm wondering, which are you most proud of, or which do you think have contributed the most to the field of hospice and palliative medicine?
Oh, wow. That's a hard question to answer. I'm always excited about what I'm currently working on. So we just finished a trial on looking at pharmacogenetics. And we worked with Rasportnoy at Metropolitan Jewish as a site, and we enrolled 100 patients, and we're now going through that data and looking at the impact of having a pharmacy tool based on somebody's genetic profile. And it is fascinating. I think that it's leading us down that road to precision medicine. And so I'm really excited about that project. You know, I think probably the CMMI project, the CMS Innovations project, was the one that we were the most known for. And that was really demonstrating the value of palliative care. It was a $9.5 million grant we were really fortunate to get. We enrolled 6,000 patients. So probably that's a project I'm the most proud of. It was a 3-year project. We worked with a lot of collaborators in North and South Carolina. And, I think it really demonstrated the value that palliative care brings to that patient and family in terms of symptom management. You know, our symptom management scores were really great in looking at the impact on pain and shortness of breath. The advanced care planning documentation and charge was over 95%. We piloted a telehealth project, which is another thing I'm really interested in and excited about. So that led, we worked with a company called TapCloud, based out of Chicago. And basically, it is an app that you put on people's phone, and it has a word cloud based on you know, based on all the data that's in the system on people that have the same diagnosis. So for instance, if you have heart failure, then the word cloud is populated by words like shortness of breath, chest pain. But you can also put in your own words, and it's very, very simple. It populates to a dashboard that a nurse can look at and say, hey, this person needs a visit, or this person needs a call. It has the capacity to do video, you know, visits with a social worker or a doc or a nurse practitioner. So, and now, I'm sorry, I'm rambling a little bit here, but
this is great.
I'm really excited about is one that we just kicked off, and we got some ARC funding for, which is using that same platform, that telehealth platform, and adding a virtual pharmacist.
I know I was struck when I was doing my fellowship, and part of it was with Four Seasons, when I was doing my outpatient hospice experience, how we would drive so far to just see one patient and their family. And when you think about how valuable our time is as providers, telehealth just seems to make so much more sense.
Right. And, you know, the thing is now with some of the apps and technology, you really can get you can make that connection right over the, you know, your laptop. And now, you know, you can have it so it's on the patient's TV screen if you want to really go live in a big way. But, you know, and you can look at patients, and you can hook up apps with physiological monitoring if you need to do that. So I think it opens a whole new world of care. And, you know, we're seeing that growth. You're seeing that growth across the board. In the number of people who are using telehealth for primary care visits, dermatology, OBGYN, cardiology. So it's across the board now.
Yeah. So I know that you were the president of AAHPM in 2017. And I'm wondering, were you the first surgically trained president of that organization?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm thinking back through everybody. I probably not, but I'm not. I can't think of anybody else.
Okay.
Possibly.
I'm wondering in general how you feel your training in a surgical specialty has influenced the work that you do in hospice and palliative medicine.
You know, I have a surgeon's mentality, and I say that in a way that, you know, there's something more, you know, I love to kind of be in it when I'm in the operating room. Everything else kind of goes away. You know, you're mm-hmm. focused on that patient. You're in charge of that case. And it's kind of a high intensity time. And the same thing, like if you have to do a C-section in 2 minutes to get a baby out who's hypoxic. And so somebody has to really run that. And I think I use those same skill sets in hospice and palliative care. When I had a practice in Atlanta, at the time, it was in 1985 that I started. And you know, around 87 or 88, some of the new laparoscopic procedures were coming out. And so there was a lot of innovation in that space. And we were one of the first practices in Atlanta to get trained and start doing laparoscopic hysterectomies. And so I think that there are lots of similarities between how I work today and how I was trained.
So switching gears a little bit, I know that you did some work in Zambia to assist in creating a strategic plan for training, education, and workforce development in palliative care. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your experience there. I'm particularly curious if you felt like whether cultural differences around death and dying influenced your work while you were there.
That was just such an honor to be a part of that project. So we wanted to enhance palliative care in places where there was a real struggle to get opioid medications for people in pain, and where there was a lack of training and education, because I've spent a lot of my career in helping to build education systems. And so being partnered with them, so we weren't partnered with a particular hospice organization, like a lot of people who have partnerships in Africa were. We actually were partnered with the Palliative Care Association of Zambia, which was a countrywide organization. And I learned so much from the folks who had such limited resources and had to make do. And so, you know, what I think we were able to provide was funding to help train some of the docs and nurse practitioners. And we didn't actually train them. We sent them to trainings. Ann Merriman's group in Uganda. Ann Merriman is kind of the mother of palliative care in Africa, like Dame Cicely was in the UK. And so, yeah, she's at Hospice Africa Uganda and ran a wonderful training program. When I went to one of my meetings over there in Namibia, it just so happened as we're flying back to Johannesburg on our way to, before we hopped on a flight to Zambia, she was sitting next to me, you know. And I, you know, she's a giant, obviously. And then we kind of became pen pals for a number of years. You love how those things happen. But anyway,
it shows you it's all about showing up, you know?
It's all about showing up. And, you know, you just never know who you're going to be sitting next to. And I have always taken advantage of those opportunities. And I think probably my greatest skill set is recognizing greatness in others. And kind of like a remora latching on. But so we trained a lot of docs. We were able to raise funding here and train a lot of docs in Uganda and then also in Nigeria. And so, I think, yes, absolutely, there's a whole different culture about death and dying. And we did some talks at the University Hospital over in Zambia, which is a 3,000-bed hospital. And, you know, just talking about palliative care and supportive care skills. And I learned so much from the executive director, Ninjekwa Lumbwe. And, I think it's the same thing, though, here in America, where, you know, you don't go in with an agenda. You know, you meet people where they are and you find out what's important to them. And so, you know, culturally, America is a melting pot, and we're somewhat homogenous in Western North Carolina. Every patient is unique and has their own set of cultural beliefs. And it's really important for us to educate ourselves on what they are and how we can best meet their needs. And I could see that so well played out in Zambia.
So on a more personal note, I kind of knew you were amazing, but as I started Googling you, I was like, this woman has accomplished so much. And I'm wondering, how have you managed to balance this career as a clinician, educator, researcher, administrator, consultant for so many years?
Oh, well, thank you. I do have a lot of energy, so I was blessed. And Amy and I used to joke because, you know, we'd be emailing each other at 4 a.m. And that's where I was always able to get most of my work done without being interrupted. You can't do it without an incredible support system. And so my wife, Robbins, who I've been blessed to be with for the last 38 years, is phenomenal. and has supported me in my career. Was the main parent. I mean, she did a lot of the parenting skills when I was at work. We have two boys that are 25 and 26 now. Having that support, she's an artist, and so kind of getting to see the world through different viewpoints has been really, really fun and refreshing. And I think the other thing is I like to play. And so you can usually find me sometimes on conference calls on my paddleboard, or I've been guilty sometimes of being on a bike and on a call, especially if I don't have to speak too much. So just making sure that I create time in my schedule to do things that I love to do. And, I have a meditation practice I've had for over 30 years, and that helps keep me grounded. I've certainly had times in my career when I'm working too hard. I went back and got my MBA when I was 57 or 58, and I realized that I didn't learn quite as quickly as I used to. So I had to put in a lot more hours. I think the other piece of advice that I've always lived by is making sure you're kind of true to yourself. And if you're in a situation that's not happy and you can't change that situation, then you literally need to change your situation, maybe it means stepping out of a job or stepping into something else. So just honoring myself and doing, what I love and what I'm passionate about.
Thank you. So far I've met only one other gynecologist who is also boarded in hospice and palliative medicine. So I'm wondering, is there like a secret community of you guys that I don't know about? Other folks?
There actually is, but honestly, I don't know many of them because I think there are 8 board certified OB-GYNs in North Carolina alone. I've met a couple.
But, oh, interesting.
Yeah. You do deal with a lot of perinatal death, and some of that is an OB-GYN. So what I see more frequently, however, is L&D nurses doing hospice. I have met a gazillion nurses who started as a labor and delivery nurse and then came over to hospice nursing.
Oh, to me, that makes perfect sense. That's lovely.
Yeah, kind of doulas at both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. So for young OB-GYNs and young surgeons that are interested in the field of hospice and palliative medicine, what suggestions do you have for them?
I think that either exposing yourself, going to the first time I went to an academy meeting, it was like, wow, I've never been to anything like this before at one of my OBGYN conferences. So I would expose yourself to the field either through, if you're lucky enough to have a palliative care department in your hospital, get to know those folks. Spend some time if you want to volunteer for a hospice organization. And just see how it jives with you.
Yeah, I always tell people, I think you can learn so much just by sitting with the palliative care team while they're doing a family meeting. I mean, you can pick up so many great primary palliative care skills that really almost anyone can then utilize in the care of their patients.
Right. I think that goes to all fields out there. And I think sometimes, in the surgical field, it becomes a very task-oriented, business sometimes because you may have a day scheduled with 5 cases that you have to get through. And some of that work is pretty technical. So being, surrounding yourself with somebody who has those palliative care skill sets really, really goes a long way in being able to talk with your patients and families in your post-op settings and making rounds and it's something that should infiltrate all areas of medicine.
So I just want to give a shout out to Four Seasons Hospice because I work in Western North Carolina and I just had the pleasure of setting up some home hospice for one of my ICU patients. And I was just so impressed with the willingness of the Four Seasons Home Hospice team to accommodate the needs of a particular family. I mean, it just went above and beyond. But as we were doing all this work the last couple of days, I was also struck by the fact that when we're providing such personalized care for our patients, it takes so much time and energy from so many different people. And that trying to make sure that we can do that sustainable environment is really challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so thank you. I absolutely love the whole Four Seasons organization. I mean, we are so committed to providing the highest quality care for every person that we touch. And, you know, our mission is actually to co-create the care experience for that patient and family. And, you know, I'm blown away by the nurses, the nurse practitioners, the social workers, the chaplains that work in our organization, because they are, you know, they are totally in. And if it means going the extra mile, they will do it 100% of the time. And so I'm just so proud to work for an organization that has put the patient first all the time. So thank you for that compliment.
Thank you. And one other plug for Four Seasons that I've often spoken about with many of my colleagues who express an interest in palliative care is this palliative care immersion course, because I feel like this week-long course where you get to do a lot of role-playing with the other participants is really a great way to improve primary palliative care skills, because the reality is the majority of physicians are not going to do a palliative care fellowship, but can still provide high quality palliative care to their patients. Well, so I'll put that as a link in our show notes.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, John and I started that in 2010. And you know, initially I thought, well, we've got to train our own providers. Why not just open it up? And it was, it's been amazing. It's so much fun for us to get to train, you know, all these nurse practitioners, PAs, nurses, and docs. You know, we had like a 75-year-old surgeon who took our course last year. And
that's awesome.
It was just so awesome, you know. And so we get to meet so many people. We trained hundreds of people around the country. We offer this three times a year, and it's always a blast for us because we have, you know, so many people come eager to learn, freaked out about doing role plays, which we now call skills-based training. It's a lot of fun. And we've gotten to it. When I go to conferences and I see people taking the course, it's like old home week coming back.
Yeah. So Janet, as we're wrapping up, is there anything else you'd like to add that we didn't discuss?
No, it's been a lot of fun to chat and kind of look back over my career in this space for 20 years, and my career as an OBGYN before that. So I'm now getting interested in longevity research and improving health span, which is quality of life at the end of life. So not sure where that will go, but stay tuned.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm so inspired by your commitment to this field, not only in caring for patients, but also in investing the time in research to assure that all of our patients get the high quality palliative care and end of life care that they deserve. I think you're super awesome. And I'm so glad that I've gotten to train with you and feel very just blessed that you were willing to take the time to chat with me today.
Oh, thanks so much, Red. It's been a lot of fun. Take care.
Thanks, Janet. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on the latest episodes. To learn more about the surgical palliative care community, follow us on Twitter at SurgePalCare. If you'd like to get more involved with the Surgical Palliative Care social media team, please reach out on Twitter or via email at surgicalpalliativecare@gmail.com. Lastly, take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other.